fate took me to Vilayet some years back. An account of my strange experiences on sea and land ought to be entertaining and educative, if I weren't sadly lacking in literary ability. In this year of the Hijra, 1199, as the unrest and anarchy all around me makes me anxious, distressed, and so often upset as to deprive me of reason, it is only at the insistence of friends that I take up pen and paper to inscribe my impressions of the visit. All I can leave as a mark on the pages of time by which I may be remembered is this account of a few curious incidents. It was January 1766. My preparations complete, I put my trust in Allah's mercy and got ready to board Monsieur Corville's ship at Hijli Harbour. As the ship weighed anchor and spread sail, only Allah could have known the intensity of my grief at leaving my native land and kinsmen. The earth is like a floating egg amidst the sea's immensity. I have heard that in an attempt to plumb the sea's depth, a Firinghi king had a rope dropped into it at the distance of a day's journey from the shore. Millions of yards disappeared, and yet the rope didn't touch bottom. Indians, who have no first-hand knowledge of the sea, believe that Alexander the Great plumbed and surveyed all the world's seas. It is an utterly erroneous belief. In no circumstances can it be true. The sea is bottomless. Our ship anchored a couple of miles from the shore at the French port of Nantes. One of our guns fired a signal, in response to which a pilot boat was sent to guide us to the wharf of the French East India Company. The whole operation took about 2 hours. As soon as we docked, vendors flocked to the ship bearing fruits, bread, cheese, biscuits, and butter. The sailors, who had not seen such fresh fare for 6 months, regaled themselves on it and were generally overjoyed at seeing their homeland again. I could well understand their feelings. One thing astonished me. The lower orders among the French are so poor that they cannot afford shoes, and as a substitute wear wooden sandals. There are poor people in England too, but they do not suffer for want of leather boots and socks. Captain Swinton and Mr. Peacock laughed at the sight of the miserable Frenchman in their comical footwear and said, "These people are so wretched because they are not industrious like the English." Captain Swinton and Mr. Peacock went to look for lodgings in the town. I had to remain on board for 2 or 3 days more, during which time I learnt a little about the people of the region and their laws and customs. The houses in the country are built of stone slabs with roofs of terracotta tiles. As the bamboo doesn't grow here, the scaffolding of the roofs is built of wood. The poorer classes live on a diet of broth and barley bread and wear coarse wool or clothes woven from hemp, of which ropes are also spun. Paris, the capital of France, is several hundred miles from either Calais or Nantes. Frenchmen and foreigners sing alike high praises of the buildings and gardens of that city, its artistic innovations, scientific and technological advancement, the polished manners, cultivation, well-spokenness, and wit of its inhabitants. In these respects, it far surpasses all other cities in the Firinghi world. The French claim that they have taught music and horsemanship to the English. Wealthy Englishmen send their children to French schools to polish up their manners and taste. The French say that the present excellence of the English in the arts and sciences, trade and industry is the result of French education. In the past, when they lacked this education, they were ignorant, like the mass of Indians. However, even the French admit that the English have always been outstanding soldiers. I realized quickly that the French are a conceited race, whose conversation was always an attempt to display their own superiority and to unfairly belittle other nations. What can I say in praise of London? There is no city on earth as large or beautiful, and it is beyond my powers to describe it fittingly. Like Calcutta, it straddles a river that falls into the sea. The distance from London to the sea is roughly the distance between Calcutta and Hooghly, about 3 days' journey. Seagoing ships sail up river and anchor at the City Ghat in front of the East India Company headquarters, about 4 miles from the Royal Palace. The city is a London's commercial district, where merchants and tradesmen have their businesses. Not far from the city is the ancient fort, known as the Tower. It is built of black stone and is very strong. In London there are countless buildings of brick, but few of stone. However, I observed that churches, both old and new, are mostly built of stone. Among them, the most imposing is St. Paul's Cathedral. Its splendid design and excellent construction defy description, and must be seen to be appreciated. Up to half its height is cruciform in design, while the upper half is a giant cupola of stained glass, such as is used to roof hammams. At the base of the cupola is a circular gallery which is reached by an outside staircase. On our climbing up to it, Captain Swinton walked round to the eastern side. Then he asked me in a whisper, "Munchie, what are you doing?" Though we were 40 cubits apart, I heard him clearly. I replied in the same tone, "I am looking at the sights." He too heard me distinctly. This is possible because the air confined within the dome acts as an excellent medium for the transmission of sound. One day, some people took me to a dance party at the house of one of their friends. As soon as I entered, the music and dancing stopped. The assembled ladies and gentlemen thronged round me in wide-eyed amazement and examined my robe, turban, shawl, and the other parts of my costume. They concluded that it was the costume of a dancer or actor and invited me to join the dance. I protested that I had no knowledge of the art of dancing, but they refused to believe me. They said that there was nobody on earth who didn't know something of music and dancing. One of the English gentlemen said that as I was newly arrived in England, I was perhaps feeling shy to dance with ladies of another race. At this, the ladies tittered with amusement. They continued to stare at my clothes and countenance, while I gazed at their astonishing loveliness. Just as I had been depressed by the hardships of the voyage, I now felt elated by the beautiful sights of London. It is a sign of the generosity of the English which I cannot find words to describe or praise. A traveller from abroad is dearer to them than their own life, and they will take great pains to make them happy. Within a couple of months, everyone in the neighbourhood became friendly. The fear which some had felt vanished completely, and they would now jest at me. The ladies of the bazaar approached me and, smiling, said, "Come, my dear, and kiss me." The cold winter in Europe doesn't allow one to grow Indian fruits and flowers in the open. A special kind of house is constructed for the purpose, three sides of which are brick, while the fourth, which faces south, is made of glass plates that keep out the cold air but let in the sun's rays. In the cold season, stoves are lit in the house for heat, and fruit and flower seeds are sown in troughs filled with mould. The heat of the stoves and the warmth of the sunlight combine to aid the growth of Indian plants. European gardeners grow Eastern fruits in this manner, and make a very good profit, charging as much as 5 rupees for a pomegranate, and 3 for a musk melon. Brick buildings in Bengal have rooms with high ceilings and large doors and windows, so that there is a soothing current of air in hot weather. It is exactly the opposite in Europe. There is extreme cold, frost and snow, the ceilings are low and the doors and windows small. The roofs are not flat like the roofs of brick buildings in India. Wooden beams and planks are used to build the frame of the roof in the shape of a camel's hump. That is to say, like the slanting thatched roofs of huts in Bengal. In Vilayet, the arrangements for performances of music and dance are very different from that in India. In our country, the idle rich hire professional singers and dancers for private performances in their homes, where they invite their cronies. This practice is quite alien to Vilayet, where a group of impresarios jointly form a company and build a huge performing hall or theatre in which they put on public shows. They hire highly paid singers and dancers of both sexes and musicians who have been trained to perfection by rare maestros to put on their song and dance tamasha, decked in expensive costumes and jewellery before an audience that includes both rich and poor Londoners, and even the emirs of the land, the princes of the realm, sometimes the king himself. The entry fee varies with the quality of the seat. In Vilayet, when a spectator pays the entry fee, he is given a slip of paper on which the class of his seat is mentioned. Charming music from violins and guitars, many strange dramatic pieces, curtains of many colours, antics of Habshi performers, dancers lovely as Horace, all these make a highly entertaining spectacle. Talking is not allowed in the theatre. Though the audience is large, there is no noise or clamour. When they are pleased by a performance, instead of shouting shabash or wah wah, as we do in India, they stamp on the floor or clap their hands. I learned that there is a coastal region in France whose inhabitants differ slightly from other Frenchmen in customs and manners. An ambitious and powerful king of this region attacked England with a huge army, conquered the tiny English kingdoms, and united them with Ireland in one large empire. This king, through his justice and even-handedness, won the hearts of English commoners and noblemen alike. He began to mingle with his English subjects and adopted their customs and manner. The English counted themselves lucky to have such a just and powerful king. Captain Swinton and I left Oxford for Scotland in winter. This was when I saw snow for the first time. It is like abir, the powder Hindus sprinkle on each other at the holy festival, only instead of being coloured, it is a brilliant white. It falls from the sky like dust blown by the wind and covers the ground, hills, houses, trees, bushes, rivers and lakes like molten wax. When the cold becomes very intense, the water in rivers, lakes and canals freezes into hard ice, which is smooth and white as marble, or like a sheet of crystal or glass. The water may freeze to a depth of 5 or 10 cubits, in which case pedestrians, horsemen, carriages, loaded wagons and even elephants can easily cross it. Sometimes snowfall is so heavy that streets and alleys are covered knee-deep overnight. Thus, in the morning, householders have to set their servants to work with spades and shovels to clear a path in front of their doors. When excessive snowfall covers roads, ditches and fields like a sheet of white glass, and there is no sign of the road, carriages, horses and loaded wagons can easily slip into deep pits, causing deaths. Such an accident occurred near Oxford that year, when a loaded dray with 13 men and 4 horses fell into a pit. On our journey, I observed people travelling on the ice in an amazing manner. I was told that they could cover as much as 20 miles an hour. I had heard stories of this means of travel from sahibs in India, but it seemed so extraordinary that I couldn't believe them. Now that I saw it myself, my doubts vanished. The manner in which these people travel on ice is as follows. Wooden soles, like the wooden slippers, kadam, of India, are taken. To the middle of the wood is attached a piece of polished steel, 1 span in length and 1/2 finger's breadth. The whole is attached tightly to the foot with leather straps. When the person stands up, the piece of steel is straight upon the ice. If the foot slips or is bent to one side, the person will fall down. It takes some practice even to stand up in these shoes. As they glided along in their white robes, the Europeans appeared like angels who had descended on earth and were moving about. After a short time, we arrived in Scotland, which is directly to the north of England. The country is divided into lowlands and highlands, the latter being the high north. Mountains and forests abound in Scotland. Consequently, the population is relatively sparse and towns and cities fewer than in England. The Scots are an abstemious, hard-working and brave people who consider themselves superior to the English, who, they say, are gluttonous and cowardly. The English, on the other hand, account themselves superior in wealth and education and despise the Scotch as being poor and stupid. Though English is the language of both countries, it differs from one to the other in a few terms. The Highlanders wear a jacket and cap, but neither breeches nor boots. The lower part of the body is covered by a skirt, called a kilt, but the knee is bare and cotton stockings are worn on the legs. In Edinburgh, we put up at the house of Captain Swinton's father. Captain Swinton introduced me to his parents, both of whom were about 80 years old. They had five children, three sons, the eldest of which was called John, and two grown-up daughters, both spinsters. In Vilayet, a marriage is contracted through the mutual consent of man and woman. Ideally, the man should be good-looking, of an agreeable temper, with an income, whether inherited or earned in business or employment. The woman, likewise, should be attractive, of a good disposition, well-versed in at least some of the fine arts, and with a portion either from her father or former husband. It is relatively rare and a truly fortunate match where all these good qualities are present. Some people, however, look only for wealth. If a woman is both ugly and poor, none will have her, for Vilayet is the emporium of beauty, where women of surpassing loveliness are common, and wealthy and virtuous ones are not hard to find. Consequently, there are thousands of old women who have never seen the face of a husband. The noteworthy powers in Europe are the Holy Roman Empire, Italy, Germany, Prussia, Russia, Denmark, Portugal, Holland, Spain, France, England, Turkey, and three other countries whose names I do not recall at the moment. These are all monarchies, with the exception of tiny Holland, the land of the Dutch people, which is governed by its noblemen. The rest of its inhabitants are affluent merchants, but as the waters off their coast abound in fish, there are also many fishermen and fish sellers, as a result of which other Europeans contemptuously refer to the Dutch as fishmongers. The Roman Empire is very old. At one time, all the other Feringhi lands owed it allegiance. The languages of Italy and France are sweet and elegant, and they are studied by the English on this account, and also because there are many classics of science and philosophy written in them, without acquaintance with which one is not considered learned. Italy, France, and Germany are powerful states, but Spain is richest of all the Feringhi nations. This is because most of the gold mines in the New World have fallen in Spanish colonies. The Spaniards have a reputation for being clever and hard-working. They may, in fact, be more so than even the English. I was told that France, Italy, and Germany put together equal India in area, but Russia is at least three times India's size. Historians tell us that just as the English are now more famous than all other nations, the Portuguese were once prominent among the Christian kingdoms for their wealth and military might. Their ships were the first to reach Bengal and other parts of South Asia. Feringhis began thinking of searching out a sea route to the east so that their ships could trade directly with these regions. Finally, the Portuguese king, a bold and ambitious man, came forward. Eventually, his fleet reached a cape midway between Europe and India. It is a corner of the land of the Habshis, or black people, and at the southern end of the world. The sailors reasoned that there couldn't be much of the earth left further to the south, and so, by circumventing the cape, they should be able to reach South Asia. For inspiring such optimism, this point was named the Cape of Good Hope. When news of this discovery reached Europe, the Feringhis threw their hats into the air for joy. After 9 years of struggle, Portuguese ships reached India. The Firinghis were overjoyed at the success of the expedition, as if they had conquered the whole world. Before long, all the hat-wearing nations of Europe, French, English, Dutch, and Danish, came one after another and set up trading centres. I am no specialist in the history, beliefs, and rituals of the Christians, but I learned something about these matters from English books and translations of the Evangels, which I will summarise. At the root of Christianity is the belief that Hazrat Isa is the Son of God, which Christians claim is borne out by the fact that the Virgin Mary bore him without having known man. Most Christian nations adore Jesus Christ and Bibi Mariam. Like Allah, they place effigies of Christ and Mary in their churches and worship them. But the English consider such idolatry improper and keep their churches devoid of such images. They believe Allah is without form. There is much bigotry among the Christian nations. If a Muslim were to go there and give the azan and openly practice the rite of Islam, he would be instantly burnt at the stake. But the English are free of such bigotry. Even if one were to build a mosque in England and pray and fast as Allah enjoins, no objection would be raised, for the English say, "What is it to us what the religion of another may be?" Captain Swinton tried everything he could to induce me to stay on for another 3 or 4 years, but I could not but decline, being so depressed at my separation from my native land and friends that I cared little about acquiring riches or temporal advantages. I returned to Bengal in 1769. I had spent a whole year aboard ship for the round trip, 1 year in England and Scotland, 7 months in Madras, and 2 months at different ports of call, which comes to 2 years and 9 months for the entire trip. For being permitted to return safely to my native country, I give praise and thanks to the Almighty.